Hello, Acceleration Nation. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Nicholas Whitaker. Nicholas, like myself, is a former Googler, or as we call each other, Zooglers, ex-Googlers. He had a very interesting story about how he joined Google as a temp vendor or contractor. He came in as a temp, how he converted into full-time, and how he lasted over around a dozen years at Google until a very painful and surprising exit as part of Google's mass layoffs in 2023. Anyway, we talk about imposter syndrome. We talk about how to move in a company from a temp or contractor to full-time. And we dig into psychological safety, the importance of it, and how little enforced it is at companies despite all the talk. So I think you'll really enjoy this episode with Nicholas and I. Before you dig into that, let me just remind you that if you are looking for your next opportunity, if you're looking to get a better job quickly, confidently, and with lots more money, that's what we at Kadima Careers do best, and we can help you in three different ways. First off, we have a digital course called the Job Acquisition Method, which gives you 10 hours of video, scripts, documents, worksheets, and so forth that gives you all the tools necessary to land more interviews, offers, and money. If you're someone who also wants the support of a community and be part of a group and get that support and camaraderie, join the group coaching program. We have Slack community there, we have a LinkedIn community there, and you employ a lot of our processes but supported with a community. And if you are someone who wants personalized coaching with expert coaches from the top companies in the world, top hiring managers and recruiters, people who really know how the job search works, we also offer personalized coaching. It's a limited basis. We only accept about 20 clients per month. It's an application process. But for any of these, go to kadimacareers.com, K-A-D-I-M-A, careers.com. Check out all of our solutions. And the last three words I'll leave for you before we head into this podcast are own your career. Hello and welcome to another episode of Sick Career Podcast. Today I'm really pleased to have Nicholas Whitaker on the podcast. Nicholas is a former Googler, or as we call it, Zoogler, X-O-G-L-E-R, and he is now an executive coach, and he focuses a lot on the changing work and mindset and things like that. I'd like to introduce Nicholas, and Nicholas, tell the audience a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, Alan, thanks so much, man. It's really good to see you again. It's amazing how many people we meet on LinkedIn these days. It seems to be like where most of my life starts and ends in every day, but it's really good to connect with you. It's good to be on the podcast. As you said, I'm an executive coach. I work mainly with midlife career professionals, mainly in tech, who have hit a crossroads in their careers and are looking for greater purpose and meaning beyond paychecks and titles, as I like to say. And we do a lot of that deeper inner work. So figuring out what their values are, what their core beliefs are, what their mindset is, what their boundaries and non-negotiables are, and help them set up a pathway towards a better future that we help build together. And then on the side, in addition to that, I've also got a startup that I've co-founded with my co-founder, Scott Shoot. He used to be the head of mindfulness and compassion programs at LinkedIn. I similarly worked in mindfulness and compassion programs at Google for many years. And we decided to build a startup to help change work from the inside out. It's called Changing Work. And essentially what we are doing there is in two ways, working on leadership development and team development programs for folks that are interested in operating in a more conscious way. And then working with other practitioners like myself, coaches, facilitators, experts of all kinds, and helping them scale their businesses and reach those leaders in those organizations to do that big, important work that needs to be done.
Amazing. And it's mindful. So you work on mindfulness, and what's the other area that you work on?
Yeah, so with the Changing Work Collective, what we're really working on is this framework around conscious business and conscious leadership. So there's a lot of authorship that goes back probably 50 years on this topic. And the whole idea is regarding not just profits, but people, and putting in practices like mindfulness, but also compassion, active listening, coaching or mentorship style leadership approach. And then also thinking about not just profits, but like these multiple bottom lines. So all of the stakeholders within an organization, the environment that you're working within, and all kind of thinking about that towards a sustainability model. So as opposed to just squeezing every bit of resources out of an individual or out of an organization, how do we think about this more as a long-term strategy that benefits everybody?
I would imagine that sort of change in the organization structure needs to come top-down from leaders, even though people can also do it bottom up, but it does need buy-in, support, and incentive or mandate from above. Is that true?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a lot of grassroots work that can be done. And on individual team by team basis, you see this all the time. You see some really amazing leaders that operate consciously, that are regarding their employees as important as whatever their OKRs are. But you really need that executive leadership, and you really need that leadership from the very top all the way down. Otherwise, you're always just pushing against that downward pressure and those goals that aren't always going to be aligned.
Are there some notable companies, whether you work with them or just that you're aware of, that are particularly good at really supporting a positive work culture for their employees?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting, it's a funny question, because if you look at the literature, most of it that was written back pre-2015, the companies that are often listed are companies like Google, Twitter, Whole Foods, all these organizations, which like now maybe aren't quite the most conscious businesses in the world. But one that I really particularly like to look at that comes up pretty regularly is WD-40. I don't know if you're familiar with this.
Yeah, it keeps my door from squeaking.
Yeah, totally. So they are a company that for decades now has operated in a very conscious way. Their employees tend to stay there for decades at a clip. And their reviews are always quite high in terms of the way that their employees are treated and the way that they regard their environment and the community more broadly that they're operating in. And there's a lot of other examples like that, but they're vanishingly few. Like more and more over time, or I should say less and less over time, we're finding that these companies that were stood up as being kind of icons of conscious business aren't so much anymore. And I think a lot of that has to do with investment. A lot of that has to do with growth and scale at any cost. And there's the pressures of the market. It's very hard to operate consciously in our current late stage capitalism that we're in.
So if you're an employee looking for one of these companies, or you're an employee at a company that is not operating consciously with the employee in mind, what advice do you give the individual? So it's valiant work that you're doing to change from the leadership and the company, but there was probably a selection bias of the individuals that will reach out to you and say, hey, this is important to us. We want to invest in this.
Absolutely.
Most companies don't give a shit. So for most of us who work for those sort of companies, is there some advice that you generally recommend of how people can manage and navigate through a system where they are not necessarily treated with the most conscientious treatment?
And that's the bread and butter of the other work that I do. So everything that we were just talking about is my startup, changingwork.org. The other job, the other business that I have is coaching. And a lot of it is actually dealing with the repercussions of folks that have been in toxic leadership teams or toxic work environments that are working within environments that are not necessarily conscious. And the advice that I tend to give folks is, first and foremost, understand the environment that you're working in. I think a lot of times we get into these environments and we believe the PR hype, we believe the recruiting tactics, and we don't necessarily realize that the company we're working at isn't necessarily keeping our best interests in mind. And we might believe the family rhetoric, or we might believe the hype of like, oh, we're all belonging here and bring your whole self to work and all these beautiful things that sound great on paper. But when it really comes down to it, it's often an extractive process. They're trying to get the most possible productivity out of you for the least amount of money in the most amount of time. So understanding the environment that you're in, I think, is a really big component. And then I think another component there is understanding what you need to thrive. Are you the type of person that works well in a fast-paced environment with lots of ambiguity and a lot of moving pieces? Are you a person that prefers heads-down work and creative work that's solo? Are you a person that prefers to work in team environment? So having a real clear idea of what you need as an individual to thrive, I think, is really critical and work that often people don't do. They just go after the shiny object and they go after the shiny role, and then they land in those roles and then realize it's a poor fit for them personally. And then they take it personally and think that there's something wrong with them, that they can't thrive in these environments.
And on that note, and you referred to Google and Whole Foods and Twitter or X as some of those companies that maybe a decade ago were seen as some of these organizations that do treat people well. Like, I haven't been at Google for 7 years. I think you're out of Google now for about a year plus. I still had a good time at Google. I still thought they treated me well. They were not perfect, far from it, and you've probably seen more. I'd love for you to take our listeners through a little bit of your, was a 12 or 13 year career at Google. How'd you get there? How do you get your foot in the door? And then how did your career progress? And then we'll get to like how it ended and how that made you feel and inform what you're doing now.
I'd say overall, I had a really fantastic career at Google. It was a really lucky decade of my life. It carried me most of the way through my 30s and into my 40s. How I originally got the job at Google was by accident. I was essentially talked into the role. I had a buddy of mine who I was talking with at the time. I think we were getting drinks on the roof of my building way back in 2010. And at the time, I was a professor at a couple different universities in New York City teaching media theory and video production. And he came to me and he said, hey, I've got a project in the marketing department for Google Maps and Google Earth. Do you know anybody that might be interested? Perhaps one of your students that might be interested in doing this role. And this was right at the tail end of the 2008 to 2010 economic collapse. So my business had reached a bit of a tipping point. A lot of my clients and the budgets had dried up, and essentially I was looking for more opportunities. So instead of passing it on to one of my students, I jumped at the opportunity. I said, yeah, I'd love to take this role. Let's talk about it. And lo and behold, a few weeks later, I end up with my first role as what they call a TVC, temp vendor or contractor at Google. I think I was working through a Deco at the time. Might have been Workforce Logic. It's a little blurry now, but one of those two. And I was essentially making training videos for Google Maps and Google Earth and working on a new product that was called Google Earth Studio, which allowed people to basically manipulate the tool and be able to create stories from it. And I did that for a year or so, and my contract ran out. And then I came back again on another team. It was called the Google for Media team. And it was a similar role, but I was able to bolt on a couple of other tools onto that. I think this was during the Google Plus Hangouts on Air era of Google, which I don't know if anybody remembers. That is a bit of a blip on the radar, but essentially we were trying to push this to broadcast news organizations and get them to use these products to help tell stories on air, on broadcast. And that went off for about another year and a half. And then I came back again, this time as a vendor. And it gave me the opportunity to now, instead of just working within Google Maps and Google Earth, there was about a dozen additional products, and there's a new team that got spun up called the Google News Lab. And that was the job that really kicked it off for me. I got hired full time. I ended up traveling around the world, visited about 30 countries, met thousands of journalists and hundreds of newsrooms all over the world, representing Google to the news industry, and essentially helping them with the great digital divide. So basically moving from broadcast and print to digital, which was a really interesting period in time and an exciting period in time to be working within that industry. And we were doing really good work, actually helping people learn the skills they needed to traverse this amazing shift that was happening. The company when I joined was roughly about 40,000 people. And it was a much different company back then. It was, you got hired on a team, you wore multiple hats, it was very entrepreneurial, very scrappy, as they like to say over and over again. And you had a lot of room to breathe. You know, and the amount of responsibility and the depth of what my role was pretty profound. And then what I found over time was, first of all, I ended up burning out on that job, being on the road for 2 to 3 weeks out of every single month for 4.5 years, eventually caught up with me. And I've told that story a few times on other podcasts, but basically I burnt out in Japan in a hotel room in the middle of the night, thought I was having a heart attack. Turns out it was just a panic attack. And that put me on this whole journey of well-being and mental health. I started talking more about my mental health journey. Around that same period in time, I switched my careers into partnerships. So instead of traveling and working face-to-face with newsrooms, I was working more with executives within news organizations and helping them with their ad stack tools and their digital skills more broadly. And then that job shifted underneath me. And a couple of years later, it was like, okay, we both need you to do this partnerships role as well as a revenue lead role. And I didn't know anything about revenue. I wasn't interested in learning the ad stack tools more deeply than I was already. And I made this pivot and I said, all right, what do I want to do? What do I enjoy most? And what I enjoyed most was teaching and helping people learn. I decided to make this pivot. I had an opportunity to join another team called the People Development Team. And that was where my career faltered and started to fall apart. And about 3 years later, it led me to a layoff.
We'll talk about the layoff in a second, but let's talk about the difference between a TVC, a temp vendor contractor, that's what Google calls it, different companies call it different things, versus you got converted to be an FTE, a full-time employee. What's the difference in the interview process between one versus the other, and how is the path of moving from a temp to a full-time employee? Or how was it for you, and to your knowledge, how has it changed over the course of time?
Yeah, it's interesting because this was 10 years ago. So I'm sure the hiring process has shifted quite a bit, but it was very task-based at that time. You got brought in as a temp, a vendor, and a contractor, and your role scope was very narrow. It's, here's the specific things that you're supposed to be doing. You're not getting involved in meetings as much. You're not getting involved in the politics of the organization. You're literally there just to like pull levers and like push buttons or whatever the metaphor is. And that's your core role. The interview process was relatively light. You know, I think it was was like two or three rounds of interviews, met with a hiring manager, met with a couple other people on the team just to check to make sure I knew what I was talking about and was able to actually do the job. And that was kind of it. I got paid through a temp agency, and most of my pay and all my resources came through them. The interesting thing about being a TVC at that point is like you would get this badge. It was a red badge, and we called it like the red badge of courage, essentially. And that was a big delineator between being a full-time employee and a part-time employee. It's like you don't have your little hologram face on the badge. It just has a big T or an L on it. And once you actually get hired full-time, that's the full process. I think I went through four or five rounds of interviews, met with a whole bunch of different people, got my little hologram badge when I got hired full-time. And then you get access to all of the keys of the kingdom, right? You get all the perks of the food at the offices. You get all like the massage chairs and all those other good things that you really weren't able to take fully advantage of as a temp. At that time, it felt very much like you were a second class citizen if you were a temp, right? Yeah. And there was actually like a bifurcation in the way that you were treated, and up to the point of not being able to go to like team gatherings or things like that because you weren't technically a full-time employee. So what that leaves you with, or what I should say it left me with, was this feeling of like not enoughness. Like as soon as I got my foot in the door, I was seeking and trying to get hired full time. And then once I finally got hired full time, it was almost like I didn't believe that it was true. And I spent probably the next 4 or 5 years worried that I was going to get fired. And is essentially like what carried me all the way through to my latter years working at the company. It was this underlying concern of someone's going to find out eventually. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm going to get let go. And all this thing's going to come to a screeching halt, which technically is what ended up happening. But it ended up taking a lot longer than I thought it would.
And what you're referring to there is typically called imposter syndrome.
That's right.
And it's actually interesting. So people say that imposter syndrome often serves a positive motivator sometimes to make you work harder, but it also probably puts a lot of stress on yourself as well of just never feeling adequate.
That's exactly right.
To hear your perspective of how you dealt with that imposter syndrome. I dealt with it pretty significantly also my first 6 months at Google, but would love to hear how that exhibited with you, how it made you feel, and how you dealt with
it. Yeah, I appreciate the question. I handled it poorly, is what I would say. I think when I first came into Google, I was already coming from like a place of scarcity. Like I told you before, like I had to be convinced to work at Google. I had not ever considered myself somebody that would fit in corporate environments. I had owned my own business prior for 10 years. I'd worked freelance jobs most of my life. And then for a good portion of my life before that, I lived in poverty, up to the point of actually living in my car for a while and living in squat buildings. I came from pretty modest means. And there was this othering that I felt where it's like, I didn't go to an Ivy League school. I didn't have all the credentials. Like I didn't come from the nice neighborhood. So getting into this environment felt really foreign to me. And just by itself, like having that as a place to start made me feel like I was other and made me feel like I didn't really belong there. Most of the conversations that you get in the hallways and most of the conversations that I would run into with my colleagues, it was made it very painfully obvious that our backgrounds were vastly different. Most of the people that I was working with were coming right out of college. They'd never really worked other jobs before. I had 8 careers before then. And there's just like this age gap too, where like I probably was 4 or 5 years behind my cohort in terms of my age and graduation, because I spent that 4 or 5 years off discovering myself and going off and like partying and trying to figure out what this world that we lived in really meant. So by the time I got the offer at Google, it was like, this isn't what I want to do. This sounds like really restrictive and doesn't really sound like the kind of environment that I'll thrive in. And my friends at the time basically told me like, look, man, like not all of us get opportunities like this. You need to take this job. Like you're capable of it. Just see what it's going to look like. You could do it for 6 months. And then if you don't like it, you could quit. So I went in with this mentality of like, all right, I'm going to go in, I'm going to do my best. I'll actually do it as an anthropological experiment. I'll take notes along the way and I'll make this into this whole like thing that I'm investigating what corporate America is like. And then I blinked and 13 years went by. But all along the way, the imposter syndrome never went away. It actually never really left me until I actually got laid off, actually just this last year. And it was like, oh, this is what it feels like to feel contained within myself. It feels good to feel whole. But pretty much the entire time along the way, what it did is it manifested as physiological issues. I had gut health issues most of my career. I had massive amounts of anxiety and overwhelm. I had mentioned I had burnt out previously. And then just before I got laid off, the year before, I actually ended up having to take a mental health leave because of the pressures of work and the toxic leadership team that I was in and my lack of coping skills. But luckily along the way, I found things like mindfulness and meditation. I found my voice talking about my own mental health journey. And I ended up being one of those people that gets called around from team to team to talk about mental health and mental health awareness. And I found a lot of purpose and meaning in that type of work, despite the struggle that I was having.
It's interesting to hear that. It's very analogous to my experience. And We both worked at Google, arguably at the time, still even today, rated one of the best companies to work for in the world, lots of resources. You and I both struggled from imposter syndrome. It sounds like you had some digestive issues. You had to take some time off. I became clinically depressed from some of the imposter syndrome that I dealt with and was not able to deal with well. I did not feel like I could reach out to anybody within the company, within the organization. I had to reach outside. Sounds like you had to do the same too. Did you not feel safe, or were there not resources available for you to deal with these mindset challenges that were having very significant, not just mental, but also physical impact on you and your life?
Yeah, and I would say emotionally and spiritually too. It's a whole package. Well, imposter syndrome, I think first and foremost, it's often put on the individual as something that's wrong with them. It's a syndrome, like it's almost something that gets diagnosed. But I actually would question that definition. Imposter syndrome, it's a phenomena that occurs because of the environment that you're in, in the same way that burnout occurs because of the environment that you're in. And I think what the root of it often is, it's a lack of psychological safety. So not feeling a sense of belonging, not feeling a sense of inclusion. And that often is coming from the individual and their own experiences and backgrounds and the way that they're raised and so on. But so much of that also comes from the environments that they're working in. The type of environments that I was in was often very competitive. A lot of the leadership operated in these zero-sum game approaches where it's like not everyone could be successful. They had favorites a lot of times. There's a lot of what I would call like mean girls club that you would run into. And there was always this kind of sense of othering that came up over and over again. And Google, to its credit, is incredibly good about providing resources for folks. There's ERGs, employee resources groups. There's mental health support through EAPs, employee, I actually don't know what EAP stands for, right? Employee assistance program, I think is what that actually stands for.
But anyway, EAP,
Yeah, so the EAP services are interesting because what I came to find out through a lot of the conversations that I had with my colleagues is people don't trust EAPs because they work for the company, not for the individual. And a lot of the work that I was dealing with a lot deeper trauma work that I needed to uncover, and cognitive behavioral therapy, which is typically the type of therapy that's given through EAP, does a really good job of getting people back on the factory line. It doesn't do a really good job of dealing with the underlying issues that are really plaguing somebody. So I had to go outside of the company and find resources and support, therapy and coaching and EMDR and all these other things to deal with this, including medication at one point. Because I wasn't really feeling the support that I needed from my leadership and from my colleagues. And I think underlying that to me was a lack of mental health awareness within leadership and within the people that I worked with. And almost it was like you were radioactive if you were exhibiting any signs of distress. It was like, all right, well, just take some time off and take a mental health day. That was the answer. Instead of thinking about like, what are the systemic issues that are maybe creating a sense of non-belonging here?
You touched on a couple of things here that I want to dig into. One, you talk about like the lack of psychological safety in some of these teams and the toxicity there. I had seven managers. I worked for different teams at Google. I've worked for lots of different managers. I've been in teams that are very psychologically safe. I've been in more teams that are not psychologically safe. And when you don't have that psychological safety, you don't feel comfortable speaking up, you don't feel comfortable making mistakes, you don't feel comfortable raising your hand, and you don't have that comfort network. And what struck me as very hypocritical, not just at Google, but other companies I've worked at, especially Google, when I was at Google and during your time too, Google did research with Amy Edmondson from Harvard Business School to determine that psychological safety was the number one attribute of successful teams.
Yep.
And Google kind of espoused that, at least for me as a leader, people leader, they used to share that information that, hey, if you encourage psychological safety with your team, you will get better output. So Google was communicating that to us as a benefit for the company, but there's lots of other side benefits. And Google measured this as well, as did Facebook when I went there and Salesforce when I went there. They asked questions that come from Amy Edmondson's research that assess this. There are teams and leaders that clearly are outliers on the negative or positive side of psychological safety. And there's really not a mandate for requiring that psychological safety, even though Google and others know that it produces better results, it produces better outcome, it's a better work environment. And yet there's no teeth behind it. I'm curious if you have any perspective on that. So you and I, like, we're preaching to the choir that psychological safety is important. The research shows that psychological safety is important. Leadership is talking a big game that psychological mm-hmm. safety is important. They're measuring that psychological safety, and yet they're doing nothing with it. What are your thoughts and perspective? Do you agree with what I'm saying or have a different mm-hmm. perspective? And if you do agree, why do you think it occurs that this very important concept that has business results is just not really cared about?
I totally agree. And I think the two studies that you're talking about, one of them was Project Aristotle and the other one was Project Oxygen. And if you read anything about conscious leadership or positive leadership out there, you're going to come across these references. Interestingly enough, one of the teams that I was on that was probably one of the most toxic teams I've ever worked on was also partially responsible for some of those studies and actually like espousing those studies across the organizations. I think the thing that you named that is really key with this is that there's no incentive to actually follow through with these things. So what I would love to see, and this goes all the way back to your original question of, does it require support from executive leadership down in order for these things to be really true? I would say, yes, it is. And if these companies really cared about this, then peg executive pay and leadership to the success of these types of metrics. That, I think, would move the needle considerably. Right now, the incentives are not that direction. They're towards shareholders, they're towards KPIs, they're towards profit margins and hockey stick growth at all costs. That whole idea of move fast and break things is great as long as you don't have people involved. As soon as you get people involved, well, you start breaking things, and that creates mental health issues, that creates a sense of not belonging, that creates dysfunction all up and down the organizations. So yeah, what you're sharing is really congruent with what my experience was. I had a handful of really amazing leaders and managers that really took it seriously and really cared about their individual employees, really doubled down on this idea of psychological safety and vulnerability, I think was a big component of this. More so what I ran into, and particularly with leaders who had been there for 10 or 15 years, was an insecure leadership style. So they were either building empires and their whole goal was to essentially build a team large enough for them to get their promotion to senior director or whatever that is, or they had their little fiefdom that they had pulled together of their sycophants and other people that would support them to keep the status quo the way that it was. And if you were not in those groups, if you were an outlier in any kind of way, or if you disrupted that status quo, you were a threat and you would get managed out. And luckily, I ended up not experiencing that personally until the very end of my career at Google. I was able to pivot out of those teams that were not aligned with my values and were not aligned with psychological safety before they became toxic to me. I just ended up pivoting into one that was particularly pernicious, and it was difficult for me to extract myself before it became too late.
So the companies know that this exists. They don't mandate it. Were you a people leader or an IC, an individual computer?
I was an IC. I was like a forever five, my whole career at Google.
Okay. So you never sat in calibration, performance management calibration during your time at Google?
No, I didn't.
I sat through several of them. You were there during the time when we used to have quarterly performance management, and then it went to semi-annual, then it went to annual. But what used to bug the shit out of me is not only was that information not really relied upon, like the psychological safety, and also Google did a really good job of manager feedback surveys where they got this data. We as managers were not allowed to talk about any of our direct reports, MFS score, manager feedback survey. Mm-hmm. So we were told that should not play into the performance rating of the leader. And that might have just been the teams I was on. So they would do these surveys, manager feedback survey, where employees are giving ratings of not just psychological safety, but also like team focus and impact and other things about like quality of life. And we weren't even allowed to talk about those during calibration. Mm-hmm. So not only were they not mandated, but they were essentially ignored when it came to performance management. And performance management led to ratings, and ratings led to compensation. So very mm-hmm. quickly, not just like any human will figure out, if you're not measuring this or you're not holding me accountable, I'm not going to do this. And Googlers are really smart in general. They figure this shit out pretty quickly. So they realize that all this stuff is a bunch of lip service.
Yeah. I think you're spot on. And I think that's so much what people feel is that lip service, I think, creates a dissonance and a disconnect between the espoused values of the company and the actual values and how they demonstrate those. And I think what happens on the individual level is that they feel that. They know that there's a difference between what they're being told and what they're experiencing. And that cognitive dissonance is what often causes things like imposter syndrome and burnout and clinical depression and anxiety and all those other symptoms, mostly because I think the individual tends to internalize them. And they say, oh, there must be something wrong with me. that I'm not able to perform well, or I'm not able to navigate these waters. And I hear it all the time. I talked to hundreds of people over the last year, a lot of them from companies like Google that have experienced burnout and overwhelm and all of the terrible things that you would experience at these organizations. And almost every single one of them, what they've talked to me about is the disconnect between what they thought that they were doing and being told what the company was about and what they actually witnessed and experienced in real life.
People will do what they're measured on. People will do what they're incentivized on. It comes down to carrots and sticks. That being said, we've worked at some arguably one of the best companies in the world, and you work with clients all the time that are working at other top companies. People are going to deal with this shit everywhere that they go, for the most part, in the work environment. So in your teachings with people, in your coaching with people, what are some of the tips, tools, strategies that you empower people with, so that they can navigate a work environment that has this dissonance, the word that you used, which I think is spot on, where you'll hear companies talking about their values and you'll hear companies talking about how, yeah, we care about our employees. And they do care about their employees to the extent that the employees don't sue them. Mm-hmm. But what sort of guidance and strategies do you give your clients of how to navigate these environments and these situations?
Yeah, it's a series of things. And it's a great question, because like, you are always going to encounter these types of environments if you're navigating any type of company at any size. You're bound to run into like toxic teams and toxic leadership. And I think the most important thing that I share with folks is, first of all, like, have your support network and have a support group that's available to you. And that might be a therapist or a coach. That might be self-help practices or other things that you're doing to help support yourself. I think understanding what your values are and what's really important to you, like what motivates you, like what do you need to be able to thrive within these environments, I think is really important. Not necessarily relying on external validation from a leader in order to feel good about yourself and feel like you're doing good work, I think is really important. Understanding what your boundaries and non-negotiables are, I think is really key for folks as well. A lot of times what I end up talking to folks about is they come to me and they're like, I should have left 4 years ago. I knew that this wasn't the right environment for me, but for whatever reason, it's the paycheck, the status, fear, they end up staying in these environments longer than they need to. And if you have a better understanding of what your boundaries and non-negotiables are, and you know what your values are, and you've got that support network, then what you're able to do is be discerning, and you can determine, all right, how much of this is me and how much of this is the environment that I'm in. And if I need different things, now I can go out and I can interview for those jobs. I can know what to look for, and I can stay nimble in my experience. And I'd say that's probably the last piece of advice that I often give to people is, look, don't get comfortable. Right? Just because you've got yourself a paycheck now doesn't mean you're going to have a paycheck in 2 years. And if you stop building your skills, if you stop building your network, if you stop seeking opportunities for yourself, what you might find yourself in is in a position where you get stuck, and then you've got your back up against the wall, and then you got a couple needs improvements under your belt, and now you can't do anything other than get fired or get laid off. So I'd say, as you often share with me, owning your career, I think, is like a big component of this. And all of the things I just listed are elements of that.
Yeah, owning your career and always be looking. And I want to cover this off as our last topic. We are all employed at will. And despite having a 10-year history at Google, 12 years, or in your case, 5.5 in mine, we're all employed at will. We signed that document, not just at Google, at every company, essentially, except for unionized shops and maybe tenured professors, but everybody else is employed at will. So that's why I always encourage people, always be looking, keep those skills fresh. Let's talk about how you were notified. Like, you were part of Google's layoffs in January of 2023. We're recording this in February 2024. Google had more layoffs, about 1,000, which is a rounding error for a company with 180,000 people, although it's not a rounding error for the people that got impacted there. A year ago, 12,000 people were unceremoniously let go very suddenly without much notice. Love to hear how you were notified of that, how you felt, how you dealt with it, and any advice that you have for people to prepare for something that could be extremely shocking?
Unceremoniously, I think, is the key word there. I basically woke up uncharacteristically. I grabbed my phone first thing in the morning when I went up to go to the bathroom. I think it was like 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning when the email came through. I didn't see it until 6 a.m. that morning. And the email was basically dropped into my personal inbox. At the same time, my corporate account was shut off. All of the access that I had to anything corporate oriented was shut off. And I only found out while I was on in the bathroom, essentially, from a different employee, colleague of mine, who said, "Hey, are you safe? Did you survive?" And I thought he meant, like, I live in Colorado here, so it was like, was it a wildfire? Was it a shooting? What are we talking about here? I had no context for what actually happened. He's like, "Check your inbox." So I went on my corporate computer, tried to log in, didn't have access. And then it started to sink in that something was happening here. Went into my personal inbox and there was the letter, right? An email, a notice about your employment. And it was a shock. You know, I was about ready to switch teams. I was just on the cusp of moving into a new role with a new manager who was actually an incredibly conscious manager and somebody I was particularly excited to work for. I was supposed to be that next week joining that team. And I had just had a conversation with her and her new team where she was like, "Yeah, it's unlikely that people are going to get laid off from this organization. We're a mission critical team, you know, shouldn't have to worry about it too much." And as it turned out, one of us had to worry about it. And I was pretty much the only one on that team that got put on the layoff list for multiple reasons, I'm sure. I was very vocal leading up to the layoff about what was happening within those organizations and was very vocal about the mental health strain that was happening to so many people. Like me, along with probably a half a dozen other people, had to take mental health leaves to deal with the stress and deal with the pressure that was happening within those organizations. And I basically spent the whole year prior recovering after taking a mental health leave so that I could come back and show up strong for this new role. And in terms of advice for folks, like first and foremost, I think it's like layoff or job loss, divorce, death, and like financial loss are the big four in terms of like traumas that people experience in your life. You're going to experience at least one of those, if not all of them, at some point in your life. What I encourage people to do is prepare ahead of time. Have a plan B in mind. Understand what is my core North Star that I'm trying to reach for. What do I need to do to prepare for that potential inevitability of a quick pivot? If I have to, do I have 6 months to a year worth of salary saved up? Have I been building my network? Do I have a sense of my purpose and my meaning and what is really important to me? So when I got laid off, when that final email came through, I had already done most of that work. So basically what I did was I spent all day Friday and all weekend networking like it was my life depended on it. And within 2 or 3 weeks, I had found a co-founder for my startup. I had found a half a dozen new clients, and I had basically turned the machine on of posting on LinkedIn every day, which has basically turned into what my coaching business now is. Now, if I hadn't done those things and I hadn't prepared in that way, I would probably be in the same spot of a lot of the people who come to me are. They feel lost and adrift. They feel shattered, and their confidence has been completely blown. And then we need to spend a lot of time building them back up again, getting them to a place of where they feel confident that they can be a meaningful contributor in the workforce again, help them deal with the grief and the trauma of these types of experiences that they have. Yeah, I think preparedness is key. I think it was Louis Pasteur said, "Chance favors the prepared mind." But if you're not preparing your mind for these things to happen, you're going to get caught and it's going to hurt. And it's going to take a lot more work than it's probably needed to recover from that.
Do you think after your negative experience on the way out, would you ever consider working for another corporation?
That's a really tricky question. I never say never. And I think actually you originally, like a year ago, I think you put that in my mind of like, I don't ever say never. There's a lot of really good companies out there. At this place where I'm standing right now, I'm 46. I've spent 13 years in big tech. I had a good career. I enjoyed my time there for the most part, even though it was hard. I don't know that environment is the best environment for me at this stage in my life. Mm-hmm. So I think entrepreneurialism or solopreneurism, I think, is the direction that I'll be going from here on out. Although if someone taps me on the shoulder and offers me some ridiculous salary and some ridiculous job that's really well aligned with my values, I might do it for a few years. But if I did do it, I would do it with a much different mentality. I would be coming in not from a place of lack and a place of imposterism. I'd be coming in from a place of owning it and knowing exactly what I'm there for, getting what I'm there for, and taking it and running afterwards. You know, I think I'd have a much different mentality about it. And I would be spending a lot more time paying attention to the other things outside of my career that fill my cup. Because for me, it's a long tail approach. It's a long game. I want to feel good when I'm 80. I don't want to look back and say, oh, I wish I would have done this, or I regret that I did that.
That's the thing about careers. A lot of us start working in our early 20s, could be working until our late 60s, 70s, depends. And they're all different periods of time. Sheryl Sandberg used to use analogy, careers are like a jungle gym, not a ladder. So yeah. Each of those branches that you move over to, like either laterally, above, below, all add to some of the adventure.
Yeah, and that's something that I really encourage people to think about too, because so often I talk to folks, I literally just got off the phone with somebody right before this interview, who's basically a mid-50s. He feels like he's washed up and he's done. He's like, I'm too young to retire, but I feel like I've given all the juice that I have to squeeze, and I don't know what to do now. What a heartbreaking place to get to in your midlife. You've got potentially 40, 50 more years of life ahead of you. What do you want to do with that? So what I try to encourage the people is to think about it. All right, yeah. So like you've had this career, maybe it like worked really well in your 20s and 30s and it no longer serves you. What do you need moving forward in your 50s, 60s, and 70s to really feel like a contributing member of society and a full and complete human? That work, that's the work that we do in coaching, right? And a lot of times people come to me and they're like, well, are you a career coach? Can you help me find my next job? No, talk to Alan. He's the guy to talk to for that kind of thing. What I can help you with is figuring out what your purpose, what your meaning is, what your core beliefs are, and what your values are, so that when you do talk to somebody like Alan, you know exactly what type of roles you want to be looking for, and you can really orient yourself in a way that's going to serve you for the next couple of decades of your life.
And that's so critical, and that is a key part of, we always start with clients on goal setting. But before we start goal setting, we're like, what are the values? What's important to you? Because I can't tell you what your goals are. I can't tell you what companies you should focus on. Mm-hmm. But that really has got to come from you. What's important to you, the values that drive you, what matters to you and what doesn't matter to you.
And yeah, that's personal. So important.
Yeah. Awesome, Nicholas. We are running low on time, so I always like to ask two final questions to all my guests. The first one is, what is one last piece of sick career advice you'd like to leave the audience with?
Honestly, I think the biggest thing for me is stay curious. You know, curiosity, I think, will take you so far in life. It's when we stop being curious and we stop thinking that there's more out there and more possibility that we tend to diminish ourselves. We make ourselves small and we find ourselves being stuck. Curiosity, I think, is key. And I would maybe tack on to that one little additional tip of compassion. So being curious and being compassionate about what your experience is and understanding that over time, your needs are going to change, your desires and goals are going to change. And you got to give yourself a big heaping dose of self-compassion along the way, so you're not punishing yourself for shifting or changing.
Two C's, curiosity, compassion, which lead to a effective and successful career.
That's right.
Maybe that'll be our title. And the last question I'll leave you with is, where can people find you, Nicholas? I found you. And yeah. I think I know what you'll tell people, but how can people find you? How can people reach out to you? How can people support you?
Yeah, if you're on LinkedIn at all, it's really hard not to find me on LinkedIn. I pretty much live on LinkedIn, so you definitely check me out there. You can also check me out on my website, nicholaswhitaker.com. I have 101 and group coaching programs, and if you're interested and you reach out, I actually have a little assessment quiz that you can take that will kind of help you decide, are you in the right career path? Are you at a jumping off point? And if you're not, then I have a bunch of other guides and workbooks that are complimentary that you can go through to help you figure out some of those things that we were discussing earlier, those important components. And then obviously I have my own podcast, the Needs Improvement Podcast. You can also find that on my website at nicholaswhitaker.com, and you can subscribe to my newsletter at nicholaswhitaker.com/subscribe.
Awesome, Nicholas. It was a great conversation. I know you and I have chatted a few times now. Maybe one of these days in person, either out in Colorado where you're based or here in Brooklyn where I'm based. Thank you so much for your generosity. Thanks for the insight. And I appreciate you sharing your story of getting into, surviving, and exiting Google. And I think you're in better shape because of everything that you've gone through and learned.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Alan. I would tend to agree. And thank you so much. It's been so good to get to know you over the last year or so. And just thank you for all the work that you're doing out there in the world as well. I think people really need support to find their next best careers. And the fact that you're pulling this together in the way that you have has been really inspiring. Yeah, keep shining your light.
Awesome, dude.
All right, take care.
Cool. Thank you.
That wraps up another remarkable episode of the Sick Career Podcast with Alan Stein. Check out past episodes and other resources on the website. That's sickpodcast.com, and it's S-Y-C-K. Alan, tell the audience about the newsletter they can sign up for.
The newsletter rocks. Check out the accelerator, XLR8R. You will get great tips about your career. You'll get honest insights. You'll get the occasional pet picture, and you will learn how to take proactive control and take charge of your career.
Very good. Very good. That's sickpodcast.com, S-Y-C-K. For your host, Alan Stein, I'm Russ Reba, and we hope you've enjoyed today's episode. You are going to love the next one.